The underwater volcano in Tonga sent shockwaves clear across the Pacific. Why was this eruption so violent? Precisely because it started deep underwater.
It gives almost like a turbocharge to the eruption.
Also today, in Cuba, forget Bitcoin, garlic bulbs set the market. When supplies are low, Havana street peddlers hawk them.
You'll hear them saying, ajo, ajo, vendo ajo, you know, selling garlic, as if they were selling knockoff luxury handbags or electronics.
With the annual garlic harvest, Cuban cooks and speculators are scrambling to buy up as much garlic as they can. I'm Marco Werman, and the Ministry of Agriculture in Hong Kong has some advice on stopping the spread of COVID.
Do not kiss your hamsters or abandon them on the street.
We'll tell you why, all of that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Glad you could make it here today. The government of Tonga is calling it an unprecedented disaster. This cell phone video from Saturday shows how it started. A wall of white steam filling the South Pacific sky, then a dark plume of ash from an underwater volcanic eruption. Quickly, it sent huge waves crashing onto beaches and across roads into homes on the island nation of Tonga. Yesterday, New Zealand and Australia sent the first military surveillance flights to survey the damage. Some areas of Tonga were covered with ash, buildings destroyed. Other aerial photos showed parts of the country with no damage at all. The Tongan government confirmed today that at least three people were killed. One British woman living in Tonga was reportedly swept away by the waters. Angela Glover ran the Tonga Animal Welfare Society. Her brother spoke with the Australian TV network, ABC.
I haven't got the words in my vocabulary to even describe how we're feeling at the moment. This is just a terrible shock.
The government of Tonga is leading the crisis response with help from the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies. Katie Greenwood, the organization's regional head, spoke with CNN today. She said they were prepared with teams that live on the islands.
And they have urgent relief items required for households, for things like clean water, shoring up their homes and shelters if they've been damaged, and blankets and lamps and things like that, urgent equipment. They'll be distributing that as required to people.
Greenwood's colleague, Alexander Matthew, told the BBC that he's most worried about the falling ash, which, combined with the tsunami, has contaminated Tonga's water supplies.
So we imagine one of the greatest needs is to provide water purification and clean drinking water. We imagine that is priority number one, actually.
The most pressing concern would be the water.
Anna Jane Laji is a student from Tonga on Fiji, some 500 miles away. She also spoke with the BBC. Laji has been trying to reach out to her family, but the explosion also severed an underwater fiber optic cable, hampering most communication with the outside world.
It's a tragic event, but it has really shown the unity between the Tongans all over the world, especially since we cannot contact our families directly.
So why was this underground volcano explosion so violent? Shane Cronin is the person who can talk about this. He's a volcanologist at the University of Auckland in New Zealand and has studied this particular volcano. He's on the line with us from Auckland. Shane, it seems counterintuitive that an underwater volcano would be so explosive, but apparently in this case, when you look at some of the satellite video, it's amazing. I mean, what's going on that made this eruption seem like an atomic bomb?
Yeah, Marco, it's an incredible situation. It's like almost a child's story. It's almost like the Goldilocks story. If the water's too deep, it puts too much pressure on the top of the volcano, and when the magma rises out of it, the gas and the magma is kind of still trapped in it, and it has a relatively less violent eruption. And if the volcano is above the water, you know, like a normal volcano that we see around in the landscape, yes, the eruption would still be violent because the gases and the magma being released suddenly and it will make a big explosion. But under that water of only a few hundred meters, it gives almost like a turbocharge to the eruption. So you have the magma coming out, the magma fragments apart into small particles, and you flash that seawater into steam. So when you do that, you change the volume of the water 70 times, and so suddenly you've got this extra impetus to your eruption, and that's why we had such a powerful blast.
So you've written that this was the big one, and in fact was on schedule, this eruption. Why have you concluded that?
Well, simply because the volcano produces mainly small, what we call tuff cones. It usually has these little eruptions that produce something that might be 1 or 2 kilometres across, and some of these poke out of the water. And they mainly occur on small fault zones around the edge of the large crater, the big crater we call the caldera. This one seems to have come from the middle of the caldera and has made a radical change to the top of the volcano. And using some geological studies, we went to that island and we camped on that island at the end of 2015. And we were able to see all of the deposits from the previous eruptions and radiocarbon date them. And one was around 1100 AD. The other one we weren't able to carbon date on the island, but we were able to correlate the ash from that to Tongatapu Island, where we found the 1100 AD ash. And we also found another one at 200 AD, which we radiocarbon dated there. So we basically found both on the inhabited island of Tongatapu previous ash falls from large events around 900 to 1,000 years. And on the main island, we found the two last major deposits from the explosive eruptions, dated the upper one, and the lower one has coral material in it, but we haven't been able to date that one yet. But certainly the eruptions are like on two different gears. You know, there's the small ones that happen every decade or less, and then there's these very large ones that just happen from the central volcano.
How much warning did the residents of Tonga get with this eruption?
Whilst we can say from our geological data, yes, this is expected, predicting something on a day-to-day basis is much more difficult. And it's especially difficult in this situation because the volcano is 65 kilometres away from where most, well, where anybody is living. There's no power. You imagine this very, very rough ocean all around it. There's no coral reef or anything. It's extremely difficult to have any instruments on that volcano give us any real-time warning. So in this case, the Tongan Geological Services had people on a a ministry boat out watching the eruptions, because the first few days of eruptions had started in the middle of December, and also collecting satellite information. So there was warning locally. There were tsunami warnings being issued on the day before the eruption. And so I think that's why we haven't had as many casualties as we would have expected from such a very large event. But on a real scale, it's so hard to monitor. We don't have the chance to put seismometers around. There aren't any working seismometers very close at all.
I feel like we should give this volcano its name. Tell us what it's called.
So we call it Hunga Hapai or Hunga Tonga. So that was the name of the two little islands that were pre-existing. So I tend to refer to it as Hunga Volcano.
Is the eruption over at Hunga Volcano then?
I don't think so. I think we're going to have more activity to come. One of the things we're concerned about is that the top part of the volcano has been fundamentally changed by this last eruption. So whether it's been blasted away or collapsed inward or collapsed downward, the remaining edifice is going to be very unstable. So if there is a large amount of magma that enters that edifice, there's a good chance that we could have further explosive eruptions or further changes to the ocean floor, which then can create tsunamis. So there is another scenario, which is that the magma supply has been exhausted for now and that we'll return to sort of low-level activity.
Shane Cronin is a volcanologist at the University of Auckland in New Zealand, speaking with us from Auckland. Shane, thank you very much.
It's been great to talk to you, Marco, and thanks for your questions.
Hamsters, they are little, furry, and to some downright adorable, but Hong Kong authorities say they pose a serious risk. They've ordered a cull of thousands of hamsters, banned their import, and closed shops selling them. They've also sent more than 100 pet shop visitors into quarantine, all because of suspicions that imported hamsters may be spreading COVID-19. The move comes after a pet shop worker, a customer, and at least 11 hamsters tested positive. But are hamsters in fact transmitting the coronavirus to humans? To help sort this out, we reached out to science writer David Quammen. His books include Spillover, Animal Infections, and The Next Human Pandemic. Quammen joins us from Bozeman, Montana. David, what do you make of this news about a cull of Hong Kong's hamsters? Smart move or overreaction?
Well, it's not probably overreaction. This virus has been turning up in domesticated animals, in wild animals in zoos, and even wild animals in the wild ever since February of 2020. It's a generalist virus that can infect, as we see, hamsters, snow leopards, lions, tigers, domestic cats, mink. To cull imported hamsters in Hong Kong is to plug one hole in a very leaky bucket. This virus is everywhere.
When Hong Kong officials say hamsters there are excreting the virus, and that's one way it can infect human beings, can they know that with certainty?
Well, yes. Once a hamster is tested positive, either by swabbing or by taking some of its urine and feces and testing it, they can determine that, yes, this is SARS-CoV-2. And then the next step is to sequence the genome of those fragments of virus that they find. And with that, they can determine whether this virus likely came with these hamsters from the Netherlands or picked it up somewhere along the supply chain in China or wherever. That's the important thing that's new about this pandemic. We can sequence viral samples and determine a whole lot about which animal or which human got the virus from where.
The danger here is a thing called zoonosis, when an infectious disease jumps from a non-human animal to a human. What more have we learned about animal-to-human transmission of viruses since the pandemic began?
Well, one of the things that we've learned is that there is danger with this particular virus, SARS-CoV-2, of what's called a sylvatic cycle. Silva, as in the Latin for forest. A sylvatic cycle is a cycle of disease transmission that passes back and forth, not just between humans and non-human animals, but between wild animals and humans. Yellow fever, for instance, has a sylvatic cycle. It's a virus carried by mosquitoes from monkey to monkey in South America, for instance, but also by mosquitoes from monkey to human and from human to monkey. It can't be eradicated entirely because there is a sylvatic cycle. The virus is living in the forest among wild animals, not just among humans. And now we know that SARS-CoV-2, this virus, is living, for instance, among white-tailed deer in Iowa, in Pennsylvania, in New York. It's passing from one deer to another, got it from humans somehow, and it will be there, presumably forever, mutating, changing, and possibly transmitting back into humans in a new form from deer or from mink wild or from pet hamsters.
In terms of a definition of zoonosis, I mean, it could happen simply by petting an infected animal or being in proximity to one or eating the infected flesh of an animal, correct?
Right. And I noticed, Marco, there is an advisory in Hong Kong from the Ministry of Agriculture and Conservation to people saying, do not kiss your hamsters or abandon them on the street, which is always good advice.
I don't want to sound flip, David, but many people consider pets as part of the family. Could you imagine COVID vaccines for pets?
I could imagine it. I don't think it's flip to think that in the future, not only will we continue to vaccinate humans, that your grandchildren will be vaccinated against coronaviruses, including COVID-19, but that maybe our dogs and cats will routinely be vaccinated against it also.
I mean, the wet market in Wuhan is still seen by many as a starting point for COVID-19. In your opinion, has the globe given zoonotic diseases the attention they deserve since the pandemic started?
No. People are dealing with the terrible human suffering and death of COVID-19 as though it were one of a kind thing, but it's not one of a kind thing. It's the pandemic crisis that we're facing right now. There will be another one in 5 years or 10 years. There will be another virus that spills over from some wild animal. It might be an influenza, an avian influenza. It might be another coronavirus. And this will happen again. And the next time, as bad as this is, the next time it could be worse. That's a scenario for which we remain unprepared.
Science writer David Quammen speaking with us about the news of a cull of hamsters in Hong Kong and zoonotic diseases. Thank you very much, David.
You're welcome, Marco. Good to talk with you.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. At least 20 people died last night in airstrikes on the capital of Yemen. A Saudi-led military coalition carried out the attack, targeting Houthi rebels. The bombing was a response to strikes on Monday claimed by the Houthis against the United Arab Emirates. Another worrying sign that the conflict between the UAE and the Houthis is escalating. The World's Shirin Jafari reports.
Residents in the Yemeni capital surveyed the aftermath of the airstrike today. Piles of rubble, mangled cars, and collapsed buildings is what was left. The airstrike was carried out by the Saudi-led coalition overnight. Reports say this is one of the deadliest attacks since 2019. One of the residents described the scene in a video from the Reuters news agency.
This is mass destruction. They are targeting houses. If they had sent fireworks to these houses, it would have been terrifying, let alone internationally prohibited missiles. And we have spent the whole night searching for the victims under the rubble, and we couldn't get them out.
The conflict in Yemen has gone on for 7 years. Its origins go back to the Arab uprisings of 2011. In 2014, the uprisings turned into a full-blown civil war. The Houthis are a Shiite rebel group with links to Iran. They took control of Yemen's capital, demanding a new government. Over time, foreign powers have intervened. Saudi Arabia formed a coalition against the Houthis. The United Arab Emirates is part of that coalition. Since then, various local and foreign groups have become involved in the war and each have their own interests and capabilities. The airstrike in Yemen came in response to another attack. It targeted an oil facility in Abu Dhabi, the capital of the UAE, on Monday. At least 3 people were killed, and it caused a fire at the city's international airport.
This attack has Iran's fingerprints all over it.
Kathleen Zimmerman is a fellow with the American Enterprise Institute. She says the drones the Houthis used could have only come from Iran.
The Iranians have provided the Houthis with longer-range drones and also with the ballistic missile capabilities.
And this has been going on for a while, she says. The timing of this escalation is not incidental, says Ibtisam Al-Kitbi, who heads the Emirate Policy Center.
I think this is because of the big losses in Shabwa and Ma'rib, and especially that the oil fields has been taken from Al-Houthi, which is so painful.
Kitbi, who was talking on Israeli television, is referring to 2 major governorates in Yemen, Ma'rib and Shabwa. These areas have major oil and gas reserves, and anyone looking to govern Yemen would want to control them. Recently, the UAE dispatched one of its proxy groups to push the Houthis out of these areas. Meir Jabadon Far is an Iran expert at Reichman University in Herzliya, Israel. He says these tit-for-tat attacks could lead to more cooperation between Gulf states and Israel.
The more the countries of the Persian Gulf, the more the UAE and Saudi Arabia become concerned about the Houthis, the more they will want to improve relations with Israel in order to beef up their defenses.
He says Israel is wary of Iran-Houthi alliance, especially because their missiles could reach southern Israel. How is the U.S. responding to all this? The State Department condemned the attack in Abu Dhabi. But Catherine Zimmerman of the American Enterprise Institute says Washington has failed to see the broader implications of the war in Yemen.
The U.S. has made a mistake by viewing the Houthis only through the prism of the Yemen war and understanding the Houthi actions as only being part of that civil war itself.
She says what happened this week shows the conflict continues to expand beyond the borders of Yemen. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
In the cuisine of Cuba, garlic is an essential ingredient. It's central to the Cuban national dish, ropa vieja, meat that is slowly cooked in spices and garlic for hours. Garlic is heavily used in traditional sauces known as mojos. In a cooking video on YouTube, Liz Muller of Hollywood, Florida, stresses just how much garlic is needed.
Now, mojo takes a lot of garlic. When you make good mojo, you want a lot of garlic. So we're going to take the pieces, a whole garlic. If you want to put more in it, just do that because the garlic is just so good. It's just the best thing.
But like so many things in Cuba, garlic is often hard to find.
There's a shortage of garlic in Cuba for many reasons, but mainly the longstanding lack of fertilizers and pesticide make garlic particularly hard to grow.
Roseanne Lake is the Economist Cuba correspondent.
Also, garlic is something that's only harvested once a year in January, which means that its price skyrockets around November and December, which is when its supply is most depleted, and because of the holidays, there's a particularly high demand for it. As a result, garlic sellers on the streets of Havana have resorted to peddling it from black backpacks. Towards the end of the year, this is especially common. You'll hear them saying, ajo, ajo, vendo ajo, you know, selling garlic, as if they were selling knockoff luxury handbags or electronics.
You can live without a fancy handbag, but life without garlic? That's a really sad thought. For those who are wondering, what do you have to shell out for garlic in Cuba?
These days, it looks like you're going to pay over 250 pesos a pound, which is the equivalent of 10 US dollars. This is up from 60 pesos a pound just 2 months ago. So, you know, the price has increased pretty considerably. And this is because there's a ring of people in Cuba known as ajeros that make money by buying garlic from farmers. They hold it and then they sell it a few months later.
Since garlic has a pretty long shelf life, it's a crop that's perfect for speculators. Roseanne Lake looked into just how much money someone could make.
So these ajeros are savvy garlic resellers. They will buy out crops from garlic farmers. They'll pay between $50,000 to $100,000 to buy out yearly garlic harvests from the farmers. They then resell them to a network of other resellers who then resell them to other resellers and so on. It's almost like a little garlic Ponzi scheme. And these ajeros make so much more money from the garlic trade than you would from depositing money into banks, which pay no interest. One of the farmers that I spoke with said, in Cuba, if you want to get wealthy, you know, forget gold, forget crypto, forget investments, buy garlic. These ajero kingpins, actually, they make so much cash from the transactions, everything's done in cash, that there are banks in the provinces that sometimes have to close to the public while they process the sacks of money that are being dropped off to be deposited by these ajeros after a big harvest.
If it sounds to you like there's something akin to a garlic mafia in Cuba, Roseanne Lake would not disagree.
It is exactly like a garlic mafia, and it's been around for a very long time. So in the 1980s, Fidel Castro initiated this way of farming. He almost kind of invited this by letting farmers set their own prices without any limitations. Imagine that, right? Farmers being able to sell what they produce without any limitations, and he gave them the freedom to sell 20% of their output privately on the private market. The rest they needed to hand over to the state. But by the spring of 1986, he discovered that a very sneaky, naughty garlic farmer was making upwards of $50,000 a year by privately selling what he had left over after meeting his quota for the state. Fidel was outraged that people were behaving like what he described as capitalists in disguise. And in revenge, he closed all of the private farmers' markets where the garlic was being sold, but also a lot of other produce. And this was very damaging because, you know, for the first time in a very long time, it was easier to buy produce because, you know, farmers had incentive to produce more and to be able to sell it because there weren't controls on their prices and, you know, up to 20% of what they produced, they could sell. So that incentive obviously went away, and so did a steady production of food and the ease of buying food at the market. It's a problem that still persists today.
Roseanne Lake covers Cuba for The Economist. She was talking about the black market for garlic in Cuba with our partners at The Economist podcast, The Intelligence. And you're listening to The World. Stand-up comedy in India hit its stride about a decade ago. 10 years on, some Indian comics are having second thoughts, feeling pressure to self-censor from Hindu nationalists.
Some of them really don't find us funny, and there is no problem in that. But they must protest against your unfunniness by not buying a ticket to your show, by not watching your videos.
Or by putting comedians in jail. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Margarito Martinez Esquivel was a Mexican photojournalist based in Tijuana. He covered police, crime, and security issues. Yesterday, he was killed, shot outside his home in Tijuana around midday. Authorities have launched an investigation, but it's unclear who was behind the killing. Esquivel's nickname was El 4-4, 4-4, which is the police code in Tijuana that means everything is calm. Joining me is Gabriela Martinez. She's a Tijuana-based journalist with El Universal and was friends with Margarito. Our condolences to you, first of all, Gabriela. As I mentioned, this is not just an attack on a journalist and by extension an attack on journalism, but also personal for you. When did you first meet Margarito? How would you describe him?
Yes, it was my friend. I remember when I started to work like a journalist. And at that time, he was like a lot of years working in the night, covering all the violence here in Tijuana. He was the first journalist to open the doors for me, you know, like teach me how to cover on the streets in Tijuana. He was my mentor.
What do we know about his death so far?
Yesterday, it was a very sad day for everybody here because the reporters who covered the criminal activity, we received this information about a death. And when the reporters start to arrive, they noticed that it was Margarito's home. So at that point, everybody knows that the victim was Margarito. So we start to make some calls to the local authorities. We call everybody to get some info about what's happening with Margarito. It was his wife and his daughter in front of his home crying. So it was a very hard news to cover, you know.
Tell us about his work. What did Martinez cover and what was he known for?
Basically, Margarito was the owner of the night.
The owner of the night?
Yeah, it's a nickname. Margarito always worked in the night and nobody wants to work in the night, you know. He started to cover everything on the street 8 p.m. and he come back 8 a.m. Every single journalist in Tijuana knew Margarito because if I want to get some info about security issues, the rule is like everybody says, call Margarito, call 44.
Explain that nickname, El 44, 44. Why?
When I knew Margarito, when I asked, like, who is this guy? Because he always used this uniform, like military uniform.
Camouflage.
Yes, exactly. With a little camera and a hat. It was a character, like someone from a movie action or something like that. Other people, my colleagues, told me, like, oh, he's 44. And I didn't know why, right? So once I asked Margarita, what is 44? And he explained me, it's a police code. And when everything is calm, they always say 44. So if you call Margarito, like, hey, Margarito, what's happening? And that neighbor, he always say something like 44. So for us, all the journalists here in Tijuana, we start to saying like, oh, it's 44.
Gabriela, how would you like people to remember Margarito Martinez Esquivel?
Well, like the best photojournalist that we have here in Tijuana. Like my friend, my mentor, and I hope everybody can remember him with a smile. Maybe not today, but after all this, we can remember Margarito with a smile and with a lot of love.
Gabriela Martinez is a Tijuana-based journalist with El Universal, speaking with us about the death of her colleague and friend, photojournalist Margarito Martinez Esquivel. Gabriela, thank you very much, and again, our condolences to you. Be well.
Thank you.
ExxonMobil made a major pledge to clean up its greenhouse gas emissions today. The energy company said it will cut its operations to net zero by mid-century. The target does not, however, include its main source of emissions, those released when customers burn ExxonMobil's oil or gas. The World's Environment correspondent Carolyn Beeler looked into what this new target signals from the industry giant.
The announcement today represents a shift in strategy for ExxonMobil, which has been seen as a laggard in addressing climate change even among its peers in the oil and gas industry. Less than 2 years ago, Exxon's CEO Darren Woods reportedly said the company wouldn't get into a, quote, beauty competition with European rivals announcing net zero targets. And yet today he was on CNBC touting his own target.
This is more than just a pledge. We've been doing work for several years now to make sure that we were confident that we had a line of sight to how to achieve this.
The net zero pledge applies only to the operational emissions at ExxonMobil, those associated with drilling, transporting, and refining fuel.
Anything from the methane that leaks out of pipelines to the emissions from a compressor you're running on a drilling rig to the emissions coming out of the stack at a refinery.
Andrew Logan is from the nonprofit Sustainable Investing Group Ceres.
It specifically doesn't include the emissions that are embedded in the product itself, which are much larger than anything that's included here.
At least 85% of the company's massive carbon footprint comes from the use of its product, Logan says. So targeting operational emissions solves only a small part of the problem.
From any perspective, it's a modest commitment, right? It really only addresses a portion of the company's emissions.
Oil and gas companies headquartered in Europe, including Shell, BP, and Norway's National Oil Company, have net zero targets that address so-called Scope 3 emissions, those released from the burning of their products. Given the narrowness of this pledge, Exxon is being criticized for framing its target as net zero at all. James Dyke is an associate professor in Earth System Science at the University of Exeter.
When you've got organizations such as Exxon that have a documented history of obfuscation and denial and doing everything they can to maintain humanity's addiction to fossil fuels, then there is legitimate concern, I think, about what that's going to do to the brand of net zero.
ExxonMobil did not make a representative available for an interview with The World for this story. Today's announcement comes after years of pressure from investors. The activist investor firm Engine No. 1 won 3 seats on Exxon's board last year with the goal of getting the company to reduce its carbon footprint. In an interview with CNBC last month, Engine No. 1 CEO Jennifer Grancio suggested the roadmap to reduce emissions announced today is something they had been pushing for.
Our perspective is still that it's a company that has work to do on sharing with the market a strategic plan over time for how their business transforms. So we'd like to see more there, and we're happy that we were able to lead a campaign that puts the right capabilities in the boardroom.
Andrew Logan from Ceres says today's announcement is a sign that Engine No. 1's directors are having an influence at Exxon.
So we'll have to wait and see how big that influence is, but it's encouraging that things are slowly starting to change at this company.
Exxon says it'll publish details on decarbonizing its operations by the end of the year, and investors say they will continue to push for a net zero target that encompasses the actual oil and gas ExxonMobil sells. For The World, I'm Carolyn Buehler.
If solutions to climate change are what you want, we have you covered with our series, The Big Fix. Head to theworld.org/bigfix to listen and read about the ways people are confronting climate change around the globe. Again, that's theworld.org/bigfix. Stand-up comedy in India. It only hit its stride about a decade ago with actual comedians doing their thing in clubs. Prior to that, comedy was mostly a slapstick sideshow inside Bollywood movies. Now that stand-up is established, though, some Indian comedians are having second thoughts about performing. Gigs are getting canceled because of pressure from Hindu nationalist groups. In some cases, comics are landing in jail. Kunal Kamra is an Indian stand-up known for his observational humor. He had a slew of shows canceled in Bangalore in November. Kunal Kamra joins us from Mumbai. A lot of your jokes, Kunal, take aim at the Indian government. Is it political humor that's getting the strong reaction?
I mean, I think it's humor in itself that gets a strong reaction. But yeah, I mean, humor is to be aimed at people in power. And the primary job of humor, and that what I learned from a lot of American comedians, it is to comfort people who are uncomfortable and make people who are comfortable uncomfortable. That we learned from, the Lenny Bruce, George Carlin, all these comedians who we kind of got inspired from.
What was your reaction, Kunal, when your shows started getting canceled?
It's actually not new, actually. It's been going on for the last 3.5 years. But what has been a recent trend is there were a few cities, there were a few states in India, like, you know, in America, you'd call the redneck region, which was not very receptive to progressive ideas. And in those pockets, live shows were getting canceled. But then it started happening in urban areas where you would develop your material, where you would kind of engage with your audience. So a place like Bangalore, where I faced my last cancellation, progressive town, actually, it's an IT hub. It's really alarming and surprising. And it's not me alone. There's another fellow comedian. He is a Muslim comedian, and he actually faced jail for a joke that he didn't do. And he has got a lot of shows canceled, actually.
So you said that Bangalore itself is a fairly open, liberal city. I mean, do you feel like the strong reactions against you and other Indian stand-ups are spontaneous or organized?
There is some rage that must be organic and that we must not deny. We are not in the business of catering to everybody. So we cannot hide behind the garb that everybody who's opposing us are people who have this political bent or this religious superiority or this anti-minority view. Some of them really don't find us funny, and there is no problem in that. But they must protest against your unfunniness by not buying a ticket to your show, by not watching your videos and just muting you. But they threaten venues and threaten people who are going to come to the show. And then this whole charade just seems too much to execute.
What is it about stand-up comedy that you think Indians are uncomfortable with?
See, I think everything is funny till it's about you. So I think we are in that mentality where we are not able to take jokes about ourselves. Laughter in itself is something that we really need. And, when you're laughing, you are present. When you are crying, you can be in the past, or you can be crying about how dark the future is, but you are laughing when you are there. So you're present. So I think laughter is very important emotions, and we as Indians, we really need to focus on how we can laugh through our troubles.
Recently, you made this comment to a newspaper. With every passing year, you said, I feel laughter is costing comedians more and more. It's costing them their spontaneity, and it's costing them their impulse. What do you mean by that?
I mean by that, there's this whole brigade of people. They're just on the sidelines, and the comedian says one thing which is probably not correct, or it's just a bad day at work, or it's just out of line, or it's just politically incorrect. That comedian stands to either lose any engagements, commercial or non-commercial, to going to jail. Anything could happen to that person depending on what that person said. So I just feel that this whole arena where comedians are looked at a certain way, and there's so much high stakes, there's barely any time for refining your art or coming ahead and saying things that have not been said before. There's just so much, uncalculated pressure and self-censorship, which is never good for an art form.
Have you received any personal threats? I mean, is the situation getting worse?
Yeah, I've received many personal threats.
You're laughing about that.
Yeah, I mean, I have received threats. But threats in India are like compliments. It's like asking a person, have you received any compliments? Of course, I have received some compliments.
What is it, a status symbol? Is that what you mean?
We're just trying to figure out the internet and trying to measure what is to be said or what is not to be said. What is threatening or not threatening? I've got many threats.
Do you still plan to perform publicly? I mean, if you can get a gig.
Certainly, Marco, I must not play a victim here. I can get any gig I want. But I just feel that if it is so much effort and, you have to call the police and they're going to give you security, I just think it's not worth a comedy gig. The joke is already lost when there's a policeman standing outside and there's double security check, etc. I don't think it's a good environment to have entertainment. So that's my point of view. But nothing's stopping me from getting a gig. I can get a gig. I can do it. It's just possible. It's just not usual comedy show, like you walk into a cellar and then you see a comedian perform for 12 minutes, then another one to perform for 12 minutes. It's just a whole big event. So that's why I'm reluctant to kind of do shows right now.
Something you said a moment ago, I just want to distinguish between what you and other comics in India have been experiencing in contrast with some comedians in the US who have said they're basically done with performing because they're worried that if a joke is taken the wrong way by their public, not by politicians, they could be canceled. I mean, both are a form of censorship or self-censorship. What do you see as the difference?
I think when you are dealing with the audience and if it is something that is going to penetrate through their opinion, you still hold fair ground. But if you are up against state machinery, then it's a whole different ballgame. If I was just against the intelligence of my audience or their political opinion or bias, it would not be that tough a competition. But now we are against state machinery, so that is a little bit tough.
You do feel then like you're up against the Indian state?
Not against the Indian state, against the people who are ruling the Indian state currently and the fanboys of their ultra-nationalist sentiments.
The ruling BJP party is very strong. Do you think stand-up comedy in India can survive this period of harassment and pressure?
Yeah, I think so. We can. I don't think any regime can take the art form out. We'll just have to adapt to whatever is going on. I mean, it's a task, but we'll do it. I'm optimistic about it.
Kunal Kamra is an Indian stand-up comedian known for his observational comedy. He's been speaking to us from Mumbai. Thank you very much. It's great to meet you and all the best of luck to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
The Grammy Awards were supposed to happen the last day of January, but given the uncertainty of Omicron and the health risks, the organizers decided to postpone the event. Given the preponderance of highly produced music at the Grammys, whether it's the simple act of overdubbing or the popular pitch adjustment technology known as autotune, we wanted to give a nod to a master who did not use those tools. Last year, a posthumous recording came out by legendary Bahamian musician Joseph Spence. Unreleased recordings he'd made, one take, no overdubs, music done the old-fashioned way. Spence's new music was not nominated for any big awards. Still, take a listen to Spence's cover of The Glory of Love, and let it take you back to a time when the artist was up front, not technology. This is is a live performance by Joseph Spence. Documentarian and producer Peter Siegel recorded him in 1965 at this concert in New York and also at Spence's cottage home in the Bahamas. Considering the age of the recording, the quality is spectacular. The rest of the album features gospel, roots music, and old standards. No surprise that the late Joseph Spence was an inspiration for artists from Taj Mahal to the Grateful Dead. Spence's new album is called Encore, Unheard Recordings of Bahamian Guitar and Singing. Even if Joseph Spence mostly growls his way through this number, it is an absolute delight. It's the 21st century, but in many parts of the world, women are still regularly accused of witchcraft, like women in sub-Saharan Africa who don't conform to societal expectations. In some countries there, accusations of witchcraft have long been outlawed. Quite often, though, these laws are simply ignored, so some women remain targets. From Malawi, reporter Margot Ben reports on new efforts at reform there.
70-year-old Annie Mvula is thin, with big black eyes and a face lined with deep wrinkles. Her left hand and leg are paralyzed, and to me she looks harmless, even helpless. But if you ask around here in Zalirana, a tiny collection of houses in the lush cornfields of central Malawi, Annie Mvula is the village witch. I was a strong woman all my life, she tells me. I went to school. I worked hard. After my husband died, I owned a business selling home-cooked food. I think people were jealous, and I think that's why they attacked me. That was 10 years ago, when the widow was accused by neighbors of teaching sorcery to children. I was sitting on my porch, she says, when I saw a huge mob running towards me carrying sticks. They were shouting insults and threatening to burn me alive. My brother called the police. When the officers arrived, they brought me to the station, but while I was there, my neighbors looted and destroyed my house. Mob lynchings of supposed witches are common here in Malawi, as in many other countries in sub-Saharan Africa. They often target elderly women or women too successful for the liking of their neighbors. Mvula's brother, Innocent, also thinks the village ganged up on her out of spite.
She was running businesses on her own. She was having money. In fact, we are very happy on those days. Most people here hate us. It's jealousy.
Today, Annie Mvula lives in poverty in a tiny home on the outskirts of the village. I don't go outside much because I'm too afraid that my neighbors will try to kill me again, she tells me. And I can't walk around without people whispering threats and calling me a witch. Nearby, we meet Doreen Kalirongwe. She's a 33-year-old with a kind, round face, carrying a baby, the youngest of her five children. Kalirongwe was among those who attacked Annie Mvula 10 years ago. I didn't really have any choice, she says. When someone told me that the old lady had been teaching children witchcraft, I thought, what about my own kids? She could go after them too. I didn't have proof that she was innocent, so I acted in order to protect my family. Doreen Kalirongwe happens to be at the house of another young woman, Elizabeth Chioza. She's new here. She moved to Zalirana 2 years ago, after her own neighbors accused her of witchcraft and nearly beat her to death before police came to her rescue. Her story is similar to Annie Mvula's. She was a successful farmer and was accused of teaching magic to children. I'm aware of what Doreen did to that other lady, Annie, she says. I just think it's a matter of education. And like many girls in Malawi, I went to high school, and that's where I learned that witches don't exist. If Doreen had had the same luck, maybe she wouldn't have attacked the old lady. Another reason why Malawians believe in witchcraft is that many local religious leaders preach that it's real. Over the past century, Western missionaries in sub-Saharan Africa spread their own Christian ideas of evil spirits and exorcism. Today, the Christian evangelical and Pentecostal churches, which were created by Africans and are hugely popular, spread this system of beliefs that mixes local and Christian superstitions. And at the center of these is witchcraft.
Right now we have the mushrooming of different churches founded by individuals who are usually calling themselves prophets, apostles, and also pastors.
That's Wonderful Mkuche, executive director of the Malawi Humanists, one of the only NGOs in the country that researches the topic. He tells me that people who encounter problems like joblessness or an illness consult these Pentecostal pastors.
So in most cases, you see that they will tell that individual that these things are happening in your life because of certain grandmother or grandfather in your village. She or he is the one doing this to you through witchcraft.
In 1911, the Witchcraft Act was adopted by the British colonial rulers. It says that witchcraft is not a punishable offense, and also technically makes it illegal to attack someone on the grounds that he or she is a witch. But the law is vague, and it wasn't crafted by Malawians. Since most people find local pastors more legitimate than this foreign law, it's not really enforced. So in 2020, a special commission was created to modify the law.
We just expected that there will be some more additions to cover things like religious prophets who are also perpetrating witchcraft violence. But we should also understand that society is more powerful than what the law may say.
That's why other countries like Kenya, which also have foreign-imposed witchcraft acts, face similar problems. But one country has managed to make great progress, Ghana. Faustina Boakye is with the NGO World Vision. She says instead of having a specific law about witchcraft, killing a person, supposed witch or not, is considered a homicide.
Now, if you do it, you go to jail.
Over the past 5 years, local and international NGOs have aggressively campaigned to get the public on board.
There's been documentaries upon documentaries and education on television, on radio. There have been a lot of community conversations. I brought all the traditional chiefs together, sensitized them on gender issues in their local language.
In fact, Boakye says, the solution to this seemingly intractable problem seems incredibly simple. Consider women as people and punish their murderers, whether they were accused or not, of having supernatural powers. For The World, I'm Margot Ben, Blantyre, Malawi.
Margot's report reminds me of music recorded from a witch camp in Ghana in West Africa. The album I've Forgotten Who I Used to Be came out last spring. We spoke to Marilena Umohosa-Deli, one of the album's producers at the time. She told us that only one of the women had ever played or written music before. On some tracks, they used tin cans, teapots, and even corn husks as instruments. All improvised and rather profound. We think it's worth another spin. Comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong. We'll be back with you tomorrow.